Mesdames, Messieurs, bonsoir. Je m'appelle Daniel Jutras. Je suis le doyen de la Faculté de droit. Welcome to this third McGill Conference on Global Food Security, addressing the water and nutrition challenges. You may be asking yourself why the Dean of Law has been asked to be the MC for this particular event. It may mean that this conference has limitless budget to have a lawyer moderating an event like this. It may also mean, I guess, that one expects a contentious event and needs someone to sort out the battle. But the real reason that I'm here tonight is to signify the importance of this event and the importance of the creation of the McGill Institute for, or launch of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security for the entire academic community at McGill University, not just for its faculties that are most closely connected to the scientific dimensions of global food security. Global food security, of course, is a fundamental public policy issue of concern to us all. It is one of the key dimensions of our future, our collective future, and lawyers, jurists, public policy experts, humanities and social sciences experts, as well as scientists, are all concerned by this major challenge. This is why I accepted with such pleasure to be here with you tonight and to be the moderator of this event. I now turn to Dean Chandra Madramutu, whom I invite to the podium to launch the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. Dean Madramutu needs no introduction. He is the Dean of the Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences, as you well know. Your dean, for most of you, he's the Associate Vice Principal of McGill University and James McGill Professor in the Department of Bioresource Engineering. Dean Madramutu.
Merci beaucoup, mon cher collègue, Daniel. Mesdames et messieurs, Honorable Minister of CEDA, Madam Beverly Oda, the UN High-Level Representative on Food Security, Dr. David Nabarro, Provost Tony Massey, colleagues, ladies and gentlemen. The food crisis of 2008 brought into sharp focus the stark realities confronting the global food production system. Rising energy prices, demand for biofuels, climate change, market speculation, changes in dietary patterns, and underinvestment in the agricultural sector in many countries were some of the root causes of the 2008 crisis. Reduced agricultural research and development in the public sector and a contraction of investments in rural infrastructure and development also did not help. Riots and political instability were manifested in several countries as a result of the food crisis. It was against this backdrop that McGill convened its first conference on global food security in 2008. The impacts of the food crisis on the world's most vulnerable and poorest were worsened a few months later when the North American financial crisis erupted. Some 100 million more people were plunged into food deprivation and poverty. Achieving the target of the first Millennium Development Goal to reduce the number of people affected by hunger and poverty by one half to about 400 million or so became unattainable. The second McGill Conference on Global Food Security in 2009 studied the impacts of the financial crisis on food security. In recent months, with floods in Pakistan and parts of China and India, and forest fires in Europe, there are once again fears about food availability for some of the world's most populous nations. Droughts in the Ukraine and Russia have led to rises in wheat prices, and similarly, riots occurred in Mozambique due to high food prices. There is concern that the food crisis of 2008 may reemerge. Although the food price index has declined on international markets, the number of undernourished remains acceptably high, estimated to be around 1 billion. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization and the World Food Program have noted that 22 countries are in a protracted crisis, a situation characterized by recurrent natural disasters or conflicts which cause a breakdown of livelihoods. There are 166 million people affected by food insecurity in these 22 countries, representing 20% of all undernourished people in the world. Countries with the highest proportion of hungry people are predominantly in Asia and the Pacific and sub-Saharan Africa. We cannot afford to ignore the causes and effects of food crises on the development potential of the populations of these regions. 70% more food will need to be produced between now and 2050 to satisfy the demand of a population of just over 9 billion. More attention needs to be paid to undernourishment, particularly of mothers and children. In trying to cope with the burden of consecutive food and economic crises, the poor reduce their dietary diversity and spending on essential items such as education and health care. This has serious, immediate, and long-term consequences because micronutrient deficiencies can increase quite rapidly. One-third of the population already suffer from dietary deficiencies, resulting in reduced immunity, increasing morbidity and mortality, weakened work productivity, diminished school performance, and poor cognitive development. Food and nutrition security are therefore inseparable. Drought and water scarcity affect the availability of food to some 600 million people of the arid and semi-arid tropics of Africa and Asia and parts of Latin America. These are among the poorest in the world, and they lack the financial means to secure water for their human development. Investments in water storage and water harvesting and introduction of water savings technologies will therefore be required to improve food production in these regions. There has been declining investment in agriculture over the last 30 years. Official development assistance to agriculture in the developing countries has dropped significantly, fallen from 17% of GDP during the height of the Green Revolution to around 3.5% at this time. Yet agriculture accounts for a third of GDP and two-thirds of employment in many developing countries. The time to reinvest in agriculture, food production, and nutrition is now. Research and development, technology transfer, education, and dissemination of knowledge are so critical to alleviating the hunger and poverty being experienced by over 1 billion people. These are the reasons why today we are launching the McGill Institute of Global Food Security. We realize the challenges are daunting, but we intend to focus our energies and the minds of our staff, students, and postdoctoral fellows on finding solutions and help to advance the annual agricultural productivity growth from the current 1.4% to the projected requirement of 1.75%, while at the same time conserving natural resources and minimizing environmental degradation. As my colleague Dr. Dino Keating, the director of the World Vegetable Center, said yesterday at a seminar on the McDonald campus, McGill is uniquely positioned with a Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences that is built on the agriculture, food, and nutrition nexus to tackle the problems of food and nutrition security. Thank you.
Merci, Monsieur le Doyen, Madame Moutou. J'invite maintenant le Provost Anthony Massey à venir au podium pour prononcer quelques mots. Provost Massey is one of Canada's most distinguished social scientists as a statistician, demographer, and sociologist. He is now, in his role as provost, the academic leader of this university, and I welcome him to the podium. Provost Massey.
Thank you. Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome to this third annual conference on global food security. As provost of McGill University, it is my great honor to participate in tonight's event by introducing the McGill Institute for Global Security. Along with Dean Madramutu, I look forward to the future accomplishments of this institute with a great deal of enthusiasm and hope. As the dean pointed out, according to the Food and Agriculture Organization, over 1 billion people, that's 30 times the population of Canada, live in a food insecure world, starving or on the brink of starvation, hungry, malnourished, unable to access clean water, helpless against environmental degradation, and in the grip of grinding poverty. The McGill Institute for Global Food Security has been created here at this university to harness the tremendous energy and intellectual resources of this community and as well as that of its partners, and to meet a multidimensional and interdisciplinary challenge that the presence of our Dean of Law indicates as well, that it's not just a problem for our Faculty of Agriculture and Environmental Sciences, but one that the university takes very seriously across many different disciplines. But this institute will be the home to innovative research, development, and training programs that are designed to improve that socioeconomic status of the world's most vulnerable populations. It is with these worthy goals in mind, and it is a great privilege, along with Dean Madramutu, to unveil the official logo of the McGill Institute for Global Food Security. I would like to just take a few more moments to reflect on the accomplishments of Norman Borlaug, who was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 1970. As the father of the Green Revolution, he is credited with saving the lives of almost 1 billion people due to the introduction into the world's agricultural system of high-yield, disease-resistant wheat varieties. As a result of his work in India, Mexico and Pakistan were able to double their annual wheat production in the space of only 5 years. The Green Revolution was also responsible for jump-starting a chain reaction in economic development in those regions and even provided some measure of geopolitical stability. Today, some of those gains are threatened by things like climate change, surging oil prices, market speculation, and crop diversion. We may begin to see the world's food supply shrink while needs grow. The present situation calls for innovation on the scale of the Green Revolution's incredible breakthroughs. This will require the cooperation and resources of organizations, development agencies, university-based researchers, policymakers, food producers, large and small, throughout the world. Climate change is reducing the availability of arable land, making droughts more frequent and more severe, weather patterns less predictable, and crop yields lower. There is a very strong need for advances in irrigation and water conservation technologies. If the consequences of these developments, or the lack thereof, is diminished food supplies, then we can expect to see rising food prices, as the dean pointed out. This would take a disproportionate toll on the world's most vulnerable populations. This third annual McGill Conference on Food Security brings together participants from countries around the world, representatives from international development agencies, leading scholars, and subject matter experts. I hope that this conference will generate new ideas and stimulate progress and build momentum toward the next breakthroughs to ensure secure, sustainable food production and distribution. The passion and dedication and intelligence of the people in this room this evening is, for me, a beacon of a bright light ahead for the future. On behalf of McGill University, it is also my pleasure to welcome to the audience and eventually to the stage the Honorable Beverly Oda, Canada's Minister for International Cooperation. She is a fitting addition to tonight's program, given that the challenge of food security is truly international in scope, and the solution also must be international in its delivery. Minister Oda, Member of Parliament for Ontario's Durham Riding, oversees Canada's International Development Assistance Program, primarily through the Canadian International Development Agency. Recently, her work has helped shape Canada's support to Haiti as that country rebuilds in the wake of the devastation caused by the January 2010 earthquake. Please join me in welcoming the Honorable Beverly Oda, who will speak later in the program. Thank you.
Thank you, Provost Massey. We've now come to the climax of this evening, the moment you've been waiting for. And it's my distinct pleasure and privilege to introduce Dr. David Nabarro, who is, by all accounts, one of the most distinguished contemporary thinkers and public actors on matters of global health and safety. In October 2009, Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, appointed Dr. Nabarro as a special representative for food security and nutrition. He is the coordinator, as well, of the UN System High-Level Task Force on the Food Security Crisis, which will be addressed as part of his remarks tonight. David Nabarro studied at Oxford and London universities and qualified as a physician in the UK in 1973. After a short period in the UK National Health Service, he worked for 6 years in child health and nutrition programs for Save the Children in Iraq, South Asia, and East Africa, and taught for 6 years at the London and Liverpool schools of tropical medicine. Having had a good experience with helping developing countries in the field of medical care, he then took up the post of Chief Health and Population Advisor to the British government's Overseas Development Administration, and in 1997 became Director for Human Development and Chief Health Advisor in the UK Department of International Development. Dr. Nabarro joined the World Health Organization in 1999 to lead the Rollback Malaria Initiative, and within 2 years, he was appointed as executive director at WHO in the office of Gro Harlem Brundtland, who was then the director general. He worked with her for 2 years on a number of issues, including the Commission on Macroeconomics and Health, health systems assessments, and the creation of the Global Fund to fight AIDS, tuberculosis, and malaria. Dr. Nabarro was then appointed to lead the WHO cluster handling food safety, emergency health action, and environmental health. In 2003, after Dr. Brundtland had moved on, David Nabarro was asked to head up the new WHO Department for Health Action in Crises, coordinating worldwide support for health aspects of crises, preparedness, response, and recovery. Since then, he has been responsible for taking forward efforts to improve WHO's performance in crisis settings with an emphasis on preparedness, response, and recovery. He's been through crises of various sorts. As you know, Dr. Nabarro was in particular stationed in the Canal Hotel in Baghdad, Iraq, when it was bombed on the afternoon of August 19, 2003. The blast, as you recall, targeted the United Nations, which had used the hotel as its headquarters in Iraq since 1991. He also coordinated support for health aspects of crises response operations in Darfur, Sudan, and in countries affected by the 2004 Indian Ocean earthquake and tsunami. In September 2005, Dr. Nabarro was seconded from WHO and appointed Senior United Nations Systems Coordinator for Avian and Human Influenza by the Secretary General of the United Nations to ensure that the United Nations system make an effective and coordinated contribution to the global effort to control the epidemic of avian influenza. Truly, again, one of the most experienced, distinguished, and, as you will see, critical thinkers about matters of global health and tonight about matters of food and nutrition security. Please give a warm welcome to Dr. David Nabarro.
Most lovely. Thank you. So, Daniel Jusius, thank you for that wonderful introduction. Chandra, you're going to help me get my slides. Thank you. Well, friends, at the outset, I'd like to thank you all for being here, and I'd like to acknowledge the presence here of Honourable Minister Beverly Oda. I'd also like to greet Provost Professor Anthony Massey, and I'd like to pay special thanks to Dean Chandra Madramutu, who encouraged me to come to McGill. In fact, I looked at the agenda of the last two McGill conferences and I thought these really are at the cutting edge of work on food security, and was thinking I hope I'll get a chance to come here to this year, and it's happened. Thank you very much indeed, Chandra. Well, you've heard a bit about me, so I'm not going to give you too much about myself at the beginning. I did just want to say that I really enjoy working for the Secretary General, Ban Ki-moon. And one of the things I'll do while I'm talking to you is to explain a little bit about the Secretary General's own commitments in this area, because I think it's quite exciting to see how somebody who's in such a senior position covering so many issues is actually prepared to get into quite a lot of the detail on food security and nutrition. But I'd like to start by complimenting the people and government of Canada, especially Minister Beverly Oda, also Canadian civil society and other academic and private sector stakeholders in this country. And my reason for doing that is you've kept food security and nutrition strongly on the agenda, particularly in the last few years. And it's time also to give credit to your Prime Minister, Stephen Harper, for his leadership on maternal and child health, on food and nutrition, both when he was participating in G8 summits and other similar events in 2009, but especially with Canada as chair of the G8 this year. Those of you inside Canada may not understand, perhaps, just how important your Prime Minister's role has been in personally stewarding and shepherding a massive international movement that's put maternal and child health and nutrition back on the map after a period of many, many years when it just wasn't getting the attention it needed. So I'd really like to have these achievements right at the centre of my opening remarks. I also like to talk a bit about McGill. I'm pleased that McGill is focusing on international development. It's great that the provost and that the senior officers from other faculties are here to celebrate this important inauguration of the new Institute of Global Food Security. I'm delighted that McGill is taking leadership on a subject of such enormous developmental importance. And I'd like to stress the significance of McGill's Faculty of Agricultural and Environmental Sciences in finding solutions to the problems of hunger, malnutrition, and water security. And you'll be looking at these challenges together during this very important conference. Now, I'm here representing the United Nations system and the Secretary General, but I'm also part of a big family of organizations that have acronyms, simple and complex. I'd just like to pick out a few of them. The Food and Agriculture Organization, already referred to, is our APEX food and agriculture body based in Rome. But also in Rome we have the World Food Programme, which, with a quite substantial budget of between $3 and $4 billion a year, is responsible for feeding at least 70 million beneficiaries each year and preventing them from starving. And then we have the International Fund for Agriculture and Development, represented here by Cheryl Morden, which is a key body for providing investment in food and agriculture around the world. We have the World Bank, the UN Development Programme, regional banks, the World Trade Organization, and the Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, all organizations that are concerned with aspects of food and nutrition and who I am representing here tonight. We count on initiatives like the McGill Global Food Security Conferences and the McGill Institute of Global Food Security to stimulate debate and dialogue, education and research on food and nutrition security. Okay, my main starting point is very straightforward: ensuring universal access to sufficient and nutritious food in a sustainable environment is one of our main global challenges of this time. Now, it's a priority for Ban Ki-moon, United Nations Secretary General, and also for all the agencies I've identified. And the international initiatives that we're going to be discussing today are part of a broad intergovernmental and international movement that is pursuing a comprehensive and long-term approach to food security. All of you know that the world produces enough food to feed all its citizens. and yet 1/6 of the world's population is chronically hungry. Between 200 and 300 million children at any time are malnourished. So we have this bizarre situation of sufficient food to go around, but still an appalling and very, very distressing situation affecting 1/6 of humanity, and or between 1/4 and 1/3 of all the children on this planet. This is a big deal. And that's why we're taking it so seriously. That's why your government in Canada is taking it so seriously. And what I'm going to do today in the next 15, 20 minutes is to summarize how our international system is addressing these issues and encourage you also to question me on how well we're doing. It was in 2008 when food prices really shot up to a very high level that Ban Ki-moon established what he called a high-level task force on the global food security crisis. And this was made up of different parts of the UN system. Now, the task force set out as one of its first jobs to develop a strategy for how to deal with all the different aspects of food insecurity, from the immediate short-term challenges of hungry children that can't get enough to eat, through to the long-term issue of how to make sure that households, communities, and countries produce enough food both now and in the future. In short, this task force, with its comprehensive framework for action that was produced in 2008, pursues what's called a twin-track approach that focuses on the immediate needs of food-insecure populations and then the longer-term structural challenges of ensuring food security for all. And I shall come back to talking about structural challenges quite a lot, because they're the very difficult challenges that we have to address. Now, since 2008, we have seen a real growth in momentum for global action on hunger and poverty. Almost certainly, if we were to go back 5 years to 2005, there would have been very little interest in having a McGill Institute for Global Food Security. You wouldn't have me here talking about these issues. It just wasn't on the agenda. And we started from a very difficult place. Levels of global hunger have actually been increasing year on year since 2003. And the structural causes of this are simply that the world's food systems do not work in the interests of people who need food. They work in the interests of the producers, they work in the interests of speculators, but not in the interests of the people who actually need food for life. And secondly, the agriculture sector, the sector that produces food, particularly in developing countries, has had declining levels of investment for 30 years. There were very good reasons for that, but we just have to bear in mind that food and agriculture were not working and had also just not had the attention they need. And then since 2007, 2008, when prices started to go up, we found that there was suddenly a dramatic increase in the number of people who were either not getting enough to eat or were taking to the streets and rioting. And this made food security suddenly become a global priority. 1 billion people were identified as chronically hungry in 2009, and although the number has slightly reduced now to 925 million, it's still far too high. And when the world's leaders said in 2000 that they were going to halve the number of people living in hunger by 2015, they would never have estimated that we were so far away from that goal. We basically have barely dented the numbers of hungry over the last 10 years. It's an extraordinary failure in our international system. Now, government investments had declined, but changes are in the wind. And we have seen a reverse in the negative trends in investment. We've seen governments starting to give increased priority to hunger reduction and nutrition and agriculture as priority development outcomes. And certainly nutrition, hunger reduction, and improvements in food security were strong on the agenda of the Millennium Development Goals Summit that took place in New York at the end of September this year. But that's after virtually 10 years of things not moving too well. So now if we're going to try to hit that Millennium Development Goal number one by 2015, we have to work very hard indeed. So what are we doing about it? The comprehensive approach that I've talked about doesn't start from talking about food production, producing enough food for the world. It starts by talking about people and their basic rights, including the right to food. It gives emphasis to people's livelihoods as well as their lives. And it says we must value particularly the livelihoods of smallholder farmers who farm less than 2 hectares, and there are 500 million of those in the world. We must focus on the interests of women at all times, because 70% of the world's smallholder farmers are actually women who are doing their farming as well as looking after their children and as well as doing a lot of other provisioning tasks for their homes. We have to recognize that food production is not a straightforward business. Year on year, there can be climate failure or there can be problems in the community. And so it's vital to consider productive safety nets and protection systems in case people are unable to fend for themselves. And in addition, the world's food systems are now being battered by changing climate, and we see that in the Sahel and in the Horn of Africa. So we need to have systems that enable communities to start focusing on climate change and being ready to adapt their production systems, because they're going to have to do so. And we need to therefore prioritize within development food, water, and land security as a selection of vital basic needs that can't be handled in isolation. And we need to be doing this in a way that is sensitive to the factors that drive both undernutrition and also that disadvantage people when it comes to accessing water and land. So we have to use a political analysis as well as a social analysis in our efforts to improve food security. I'm not talking about massive increases in agricultural production. I'm not talking about mechanization of farms, though that's important. I'm talking about thinking of food, food systems, and nutrition with people at the center rather than production systems at the center, and recognizing the political and social and economic realities of the lives of the billion who are chronically hungry. It is actually quite a big shift. It's seeing food security and nutrition as much a social science as a natural science. Now, we have one additional big worry, and that is we've got communities and countries that are affected by prolonged food insecurity or recurrent shocks, like, for example, those in Sahel or Horn of Africa or Yemen, who are at risk not only of chronic undernutrition and insecurity, but who may not be able easily to re-establish production systems that give them the security they need, particularly the millions of people who depend on pastoralism for their lives, who with their animals move in search of water, who are often competing for that water with settled farmers and perhaps sometimes in conflict with them. They need special attention. We've identified this year 22 countries which are affected by these prolonged crises, which are often also not having strong governments and which need special help to cope with the impact of prolonged insecurity and also to build the necessary institutions and regional solidarity that will enable them to hopefully recover from the kind of prolonged crisis without descending into some kind of political implosion. And this is a very serious worry indeed for the future of our world, that there are these countries that are suffering from such dramatic and protracted food insecurity that it's difficult to see how they're going to come out of it, especially with climate changing in the way it is. And that's why we're recognizing that as well as investing, therefore, in agriculture, food production, and processing systems, we have to also invest in social protection schemes that can help poor rural people expand their assets, use them more efficiently, and adopt higher return activities, not just in agriculture, but also in off-farm action. I mean, if you actually look at the history over the last 30 years, social protection for people living in rural areas has been virtually absent from the development agenda. And the result has been that whenever things go bad in the villages, the immediate reaction is people move quickly to urban areas. Why else has there been such an incredible build-up of urban migration and the incapacity of rural areas to provide employment, particularly for young men, that will keep them living there rather than travelling to the towns? In many settings, I have to say, trade is also key to food security. The trade agenda offers more possibilities for countries to successfully invest in agriculture and prosper food agriculture than just about any other investment area. But of course, if countries that produce food cannot access markets within which to sell them because tariffs price them out of those markets, or because others come and sell food at a below economic production price and can compete with the producers for access to markets, we have a serious problem on our hands. And so one of the issues that we've identified in the Secretary General's task force is the need to try to find ways to get trade in agricultural commodities treated for what it is, which is as supplying the basic needs for human development and well-being, rather than trade in agricultural commodities being part of some kind of global speculative activity that people use as ways of protecting their investments. So the policy coherence between food security and trade on the one hand and poverty reduction is key, and it's one on which we are all working quite intensively. It's excellent that Pascal Lamy, who is the head of the World Trade Organization, has himself embraced the need to ensure that trade in food takes seriously the interests of people who are most short of food. Now, concerted efforts from the international community, particularly from ministers responsible for food security, is needed to sustain these recent positive trends and the kind of new initiatives that are emerging to address all the dimensions of food security. And this slide, which I put up here, which is impossible for you to read, and I apologize for that, but it does at least show that for working on food security, we have four dimensions that have to be considered: availability, access, utilization, and stability. Food production, access to that food, consumption of the food to produce the nutrients that are needed for good nutrition, and stability of supplies over time. It's these four dimensions that need to be taken into account in all food security policies and practice. If you concentrate on one or the other, it will not be good enough. And I would encourage all of you to recognize that it's that holistic and comprehensive approach to food security is the key. And this is my commercial. This is the updated comprehensive framework for action that we just finished about 3 weeks ago. It involved intensive negotiation, but it does try to cover all these dimensions in an effective way. Now, the second and last part of my talk is about the international initiatives that are then being applied to try to take forward this comprehensive approach to food security. For those of you who study how the international system works, this has got really interesting. Essentially, what we have to recognize is that we need to have various different pieces in place for the international system to work. If you look up at the slide, bottom left-hand circle is about research and analysis. We can't move forward on food security without the combination of natural science and social science research that helps us to understand what is happening. And we have a variety of different new approaches emerging, particularly the reform of the consultative group on international agricultural research, but also the creation of a high-level panel of experts, which is a new thing that is designed to help ensure that the best of science is available for policymakers at all times. I mention that one first because you in McGill will have the capacity to contribute more and more to this kind of global science, and it is the key.
Secondly, we need to be sure that there is a capacity for financial investment. And I'm not just talking here about aid money that comes through aid agencies. That's critical and important. But because 95%+ of food work is done through the private sector, we need to also create the environment within which private investment can be improved, with the public sector invested in infrastructure, regulations and legislation, and other similar key public tasks, but the private sector coming in with the resources. It's got to be done responsibly, and one of the things we have to watch out for is irresponsible capturing of land, particularly by overseas investors, that then disadvantage people. So the financial investment has got to be well done, coordinated, responsible, and legislated for or regulated in whatever means we can. Thirdly, we need technical support. In the international environment on food security, the role of the international organizations of the UN system, the development banks, the CGIAR organizations like IFPRI is key, together with regional bodies like the African Union with the Comprehensive Africa Agriculture Development Program and the like. And so one of the jobs that we've been putting in place over the last 3 years is making sure that those technical organizations are properly coordinated. That's part of my job within the context of our high-level task force. Increasingly, over the last 3 years, civil society has become more important in the whole area of global food security. Farmers' organizations, women's organizations, whether they are involved in agriculture or not, and then civil society groups concerned with trade, concerned with the right to food, and other key areas. Over the last 3 years, space has been created for them to be much more involved in the dialogue. I think because the institutions involved in food have realized that because they didn't put these issues, particularly of people's rights, at the center of their work, big mistakes were being made. So activists are acutely involved. And then to hold all this together, during the last year, we've seen a new system of global governance for food security emerge. It's one of the most exciting experiments that we've seen. It's called the Committee on Food Security. It's been revitalized, and it provides space for civil society, private sector, international bodies, and governments to work together addressing food issues. It's just completed its first meeting as a revitalized body in Rome last week. Some of us were there. And one of the outcomes of that has been much greater attention to land acquisition, to volatility of prices, and to the kind of prolonged crises that I've just described. One particular part of the financial investment has been the creation of a new approach following the L'Aquila summit in 2009, a G8 approach, where a large amount of resources were pledged for food security, $22 billion, and Canada led the way in ensuring that there has been tight tracking and accounting for these resources. A particularly useful part of this was something that was called for by the G20 when they met in Pittsburgh in 2009, asking for a global agriculture and food security program that would provide grants to well-prepared national food security investment plans. Canada, along with the US, Spain, Korea, and the Gates Foundation, more recently Ireland and Australia, has been a key contributor to this funding mechanism. And GASP has provided a really efficient system for aid effectiveness because it enables recipients and donors to know where their money is and also to have an independent process for allocating those funds through an independent technical advisory committee. People in this room have played a major role in setting up that system and making sure that it adheres to the Rome principles, which supports country-led plans through a comprehensive approach. I'd just like now to summarize some of my own priority concerns as I move forward from now. We really do have to give a real emphasis to food security in all our activities and try to realize the first Millennium Development Goal. Otherwise, it's going to be a really big and embarrassing miss. This means keeping people and their food and nutritional security at the center of all that we do. It means maintaining the focus on smallholder agriculture, small-scale farmers, agribusinesses, processors, and markets. It means building the capacity of farmers' organizations and associations, especially women producer and processor associations, so they can be fully involved in policymaking and empowered in practice, working for poor people, means listening to them and working with them. Because most of the food production, processing, marketing, and trading is a private activity, we must have functional links between businesses, farmers' organizations, and government. We have many examples of such partnerships and functional links blossoming now for input and credit, such as the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, work along growth corridors in Mozambique or Southern Highlands of Tanzania, for safer livestock, such as efforts to reduce avian influenza in poultry, for specific products like cashews, potatoes, or flowers, and also for enabling producers to get better access to the value of their processed products through post-harvest cold stores or dairy development. Mark my words, the real exciting areas of progress are the public-private partnerships, provided they are based on farmer organizations and bring benefits to the small-scale producers. We must pay special attention to nutrition now, particularly between conception and the child's second birthday, scaling up nutrition-sensitive development and providing proven nutrition-specific interventions to reduce the risk of long-term physical and mental impairment. We have no excuse. It's utterly doable. Brazil has shown us how to do it, but we have failed badly on nutrition. And it means that if we go on under a business-as-usual scenario, there are some nations, these 22 nations that I've identified, in which food, water, and land insecurity is set to increase, particularly as a result of climate change. We can no longer rely on the traditional dichotomy of humanitarian aid and development aid to respond to those problems. To take this work forward, we need committed leaders who will not rest till all the world's people enjoy food and nutrition security. We need consistent, predictable, and coordinated international assistance to support governments that are taking these problems seriously. But most importantly, we need movements that bring different stakeholders together, working on common platforms, whether they're private sector, civil society or public sector, academic or practitioner, short-term or long-term, demonstrating and communicating results so that those who provide the funds can see what has been achieved with their contributions and backing it all with the highest quality science. These are all areas in which, frankly, Canada is at the forefront, thanks to the way in which the government, civil society, and private sector actors in this country have moved forward. Thank you for what you've done, and I look forward to continuing to work with the Canadian government and its institutions in my various roles, and also to staying engaged with the new McGill Institute for Global Food Security. I expect your institute to be challenging us, to be asking questions of us, and to be helping us find solutions. Minister Oda, Provost Massey, Dean Madramutu, thank you very much indeed for the privilege of sharing this event with you and with your guests. Thank you for your leadership, your commitment, your inspiration, and your humility. It's these rare qualities that will enable us all to achieve our collective goals.
Thank you very much, Dr. Nabarro, for this absolutely remarkable roadmap that you're presenting to us and challenge as well, I think, to Western communities, scientists, academics generally, to rethink the overall relationship between individuals and structures in overcoming the problem of food safety and nutrition. I now turn to the Honorable Beverly Oda, our Minister of International Cooperation, to come forward and say a few words on behalf of the Canadian government. Mr. Oda.
If you don't mind, I'm not as tall as Dr. Nabarro. Well, thank you, Dean Jutras. Provost Massey, Dean Madramutu, Dr. Nabarro, and ladies and gentlemen, thank you for the invitation to be with you this evening. I would also like to thank Dr. Nabarro for his continued efforts in leading the UN High-Level Task Force on Food Security. Under the leadership of Ban Ki-moon, who had the insight to appoint Dr. Nabarro to various high-responsibility roles, we also know that Ban Ki-moon, with the support of all of the leadership that he has at various agencies, to develop various action plans related to women, mothers, food security, and children. And for example, the Sun Action Plan and the 1,000-day window of opportunity for mothers and children that were exposed and presented to us at the MDG Summit. So we certainly support all of the efforts of the UN agencies. David, your presentation today will also help advance our discussions, particularly regarding the theme of this conference, addressing the water and nutrition challenges. And thank you, David, for recognizing the steps that Canada has taken and the support we are giving to international efforts regarding food security and nutrition. In fact, David, we've been working together over the past year to ensure that Canada and other donors are making a difference and managing for results. This means having the right results framework and the right indicators to measure our progress in all sectors, including water and nutrition. Food security is a complex issue, as we were told, that requires complex solutions. You can't grow food without the right agricultural conditions and sufficient water. You cannot increase productivity without the knowledge of how to get the most out of the land available to you. You can't increase the health of people unless you maximize the nutritional value of the produce and the livestock being delivered. You can't get food to the people who need it without a system that links farmers to markets. And while the understanding of food as a basic human need must always be respected, we must always remember the indisputable link between food security, agriculture, and sustainable economic growth. All of this calls for a comprehensive and integrated approach that includes all traditional development partners, but must also include, as David has so rightly pointed out, the private sector as full participants as well. Recently, we've been presented with challenges that are threatening the gains we had been making in our development work. The food crisis of 2008-09 increased the number facing extreme hunger and starvation. The global economic crisis put strains on the most vulnerable as costs grew and resources were limited. And we cannot turn a blind eye to the issue of climate change. The incidence and severity of natural disasters has had severe impact. These three major factors alone have presented us all with additional challenges in the complex world of development. The Canadian International Development Agency has been working closely with other donors and our international and Canadian partners to put our heads and wallets together for greater impact. We recognize that a comprehensive and integrated approach on water and nutrition is the only way to make real progress on food security and healthier populations. We know that integrating health, agriculture, rural development, environment, economic growth, and education together produce the most meaningful development results. We know that having access to good potable water for drinking, irrigation, and sanitation is absolutely critical for healthy communities and sustainable agriculture. Desertification reduces the land's resilience to natural variations in climate and disrupts the natural cycle of water and nutrient turnover. Furthermore, land degradation threatens the sustainability of crop production through eroded lands and reduced yields. The vulnerability of smallholder farmers increases as the pressures to grow more food on less quality land increases. Canada has maintained its support for agriculture, and at the G8 to L'Aquila Summit, Canada doubled its investment in food security and agriculture, focusing particularly on smallholder farmers. Canada believes that we must increase and share research and knowledge about such issues as how to become more resilient to natural disasters and the use of drought-resistant seeds with the small-scale farmers who are the backbone of agriculture in developing countries. That is why, as part of Canada's new food security strategy, CETA and the International Development Research Centre launched the Canadian International Food Security Research Fund, or CIFS, to support practical, applied food security research working with researchers in developing countries. And I would like to congratulate McGill University on establishing the McGill Institute on Global Food Security that will be training and offering opportunities to the next generation of researchers whose work, hopefully, will someday be supported by the CIFS Fund in the future. This fund builds on Canada's long-standing contribution as a founding member of the Consultative Group on International Agriculture Research, or CIGAR. The World Bank estimates that for every dollar invested in research by CIGAR, more than $9 worth of additional food is produced in developing countries. This past year, we have contributed $32.5 million to two innovative CIGAR programs. First, the Harvest Plus program, which focuses on biofortification to increase the nutrient values of staple foods. And this year, Harvest Plus is scaling up the use of vitamin A-rich sweet potatoes in East Africa, especially Uganda and Mozambique. I like sweet potatoes. And secondly, CIGAR's Climate Change and Agriculture and Food Security program that explores new ways to help vulnerable rural communities adjust to the climate, to the impact of climate change. Through this kind of support for research and development, including our support for the Forum for Agricultural Research in Africa, Canada hopes that successes such as CETA's initiative in Africa to develop 101 new bean varieties that are resistant to disease and tolerate poor soil conditions will be duplicated. These new bean varieties were made available to more than 35 million low-income people in Africa, where bean consumption is the highest in the world. This project also allowed nearly 3 million farmers, more than half of them women, to use new approaches to soil, pest, and disease management. One of the biggest challenges to food security in developing countries is gaining access to quality, nutritious food. It's not just about getting food on the table. It's about getting better, more nutritious food on the same tables. It's a tragedy that millions of the world's most vulnerable do not get enough iron, iodine, vitamin A, folic acid, and zinc in their diets, leading to illnesses, blindness, impaired mental development, and death. That is why our own G8 Muskoka Initiative for Maternal, Newborn, and Child Health puts special emphasis on nutrition, because we recognize the catalytic effect it can have on the lives of mothers and young children. And it is a key focus of our food security strategy that identifies the importance of nutrition within our work in agriculture, education, children, and youth. Our work with the Global Partnership for Scaling Up Nutrition is helping to bring global attention to this largely forgotten aspect of food security, as is our significant support for Canada's micronutrient initiative. MI has been investing in new innovative ways to increase the health factors in foods and has, for example, established in partnership with the World Food Program a women's cooperative in Senegal that is now producing iodized salt for many West African countries. Even in Canada's humanitarian work, nutrition is an important consideration. When the rising food costs and hurricanes hit Haiti, affecting more than 800,000 people, through Oxfam Quebec, Canada helped small-scale farmers rebuild and add vegetables such as sweet potatoes, tomatoes, and eggplants to their family diet. One of CETA's core messages in our development work, including in our food security strategy, is that women are key. Key to food security because as smallholder farmers, they are the backbone of agriculture in developing countries. And key because they are the guardians of family nutrition. It is important to remember that 500 million small-scale farmers feed more than 2 billion people, or one-third of humanity. In many developing countries, especially in Africa and Asia, the majority of these smallholder farmers are women. They are quite literally the backbone of rural economy and the key to family health and community health, particularly amongst the poorest. And because women are the linchpin of smallholder agriculture in developing country, they must be at the center of any food security strategy. That is why Canada has increased its support for the International Fund for Agricultural Development, or IFAD, making Canada the world's fifth largest contributor. IFAD is helping more than 340 million smallholder farmers, mostly women, to improve their business practices, adapt to climate change, rehabilitate their farmlands, access finance, and develop their markets. We all know that empowering women with literacy, education, and knowledge lifts the education of future generations, improves the health of families, and supports the stability of communities. So, sweet potatoes and women are important to me. These are all outcomes we share as objectives in our collective effort to reduce poverty and improve the lives of the world's most vulnerable. To achieve not only the results, the outputs, and the outcomes, each very different, results, outputs, and outcomes that we all strive for means we must maximize the impact of our aid and development dollars with comprehensive and integrated approaches on the part of all participants, particularly not only at the international level, but particularly at the country level. It means ensuring that the historic segmented division of our work and vertical approaches must become more closely aligned. And I commend the United Nations in the efforts under Dr. Nabarro's leadership to ensure that within the UN family, we are maximizing that coherence and integration. It means supporting country strategies and plans, particularly in those countries that recognize the need not only for a food security strategy, but also a nutrition plan. It requires donor countries to make meaningful commitments and to fulfill their pledges, as well as being accountable for their commitments and the results being achieved. And because we can't manage what we cannot measure, it requires the international community to establish and agree on common sets of indicators, quality indicators, and the willingness to have results be measured against those indicators. It also means our willingness to be transparent and report regularly on the progress being achieved, and the challenges we are facing. As Dr. Nabarro pointed out, it was only a couple of weeks, a few weeks ago, that we looked at the progress being made in achieving the Millennium Development Goals at the United Nations. When I was there, I was struck by the fact that never before in the history of international efforts had so many development partners been so aligned in their commitments, in their pledges for accountability, and their willingness to look to innovation and concrete actions to reach the MDG goals by 2015. Canada is proud to be part of this renewed pledge to action. And as I said in my opening, development work is very complex. Food security for the entire globe is even more complex. Despite the challenges we presently face, the ones yet to be brought upon us, and how much work that still needs to be done, I have the faith that going forward, our collective efforts will have an even more powerful impact. Thank you.
Minister Oda, thank you very much for this very exhaustive and helpful overview of Canada's contribution to global food security. Good things come in threes. I think I pick up from your presentation the value of sweet potatoes, the role of women, and the creation of a new Canadian International Research Fund on food security, which is of great interest to us as academics. We have, Mr. Dean, maybe a few minutes, one question or two questions to Dr. Nabarro. There are two microphones. I would invite the lucky person or a couple of persons who will get to ask their question to come forward right now and ask their question. Please, Mr. Gentleman at the front right here. Sir? You could keep your question very short.
Pardon?
If you could keep your question very short, I'd be grateful.
Well, I hope so. We've been given a pretty clear picture of the situation of food security globally, and the challenges are quite monumental, I'm sure. But there's one aspect of the problem which I think is usually overlooked, or at least I think it seems to be overlooked, and that is the question of population numbers. And population numbers is really at the root of these problems. When I was born, there were barely 2 billion people on the earth. Today, we are nearing 7 billion. Not so long ago, maybe 6 or 7 years ago, we hit the threshold of 6 billion. We are almost 7 billion now. So I think that along with any program to secure food security, I think there should be a parallel program to put a check on population numbers somehow. Mind you, I have no answer and I have no solution for the problem, but I think that the problem is there. And also, if we put a check on population numbers, we will really create a problem on economics, because the more people there are, the livelier the economy. If we put a check on population numbers, the economy will suffer. I have no solution, but I would wish that the economists would give us an answer to that problem. Anyway, population numbers should really be part of the equation. Thank you.
Dr. Nabarro, do you want to address this question?
I'd just like to say I totally agree. I think I wouldn't quite express it that way. And we have abundant evidence that when women and men are able to choose how many children they have quite small family sizes. But in so many situations, they don't have access to the means through which they can, if they wish to, choose whether or not to have children. And so I would agree with you that it is absolutely vital to sustain effective reproductive health programs. And I am personally concerned to try to maintain investment in them. I was with the governor of Bangladesh last week with two ministers, and we were looking at the trends in funding for reproductive health programs in that country, which are absolutely critical to help keep the population stabilized, and we're finding that the funding is not holding up well enough. So I think your point is well taken, and I probably should have mentioned it. Thank you.
At the back.
Dr. Navarro, I would suggest we are faced with a double bind problem. Those countries that have the problems lack the means to solve them, and those countries that have the means lack the will to be generous enough to share their wealth. So I don't know how we can get out of this conundrum, and I would suggest that the problem of population is something of a red herring, because should all populations cease growing tomorrow, we would still have billions of people living in poverty and malnourished. So that's often used more of an excuse to justify not doing enough than really being concerned with humanity.
Thank you.
Thank you. We're in a very difficult situation at the moment. Just right now, a number of governments have decided that they are finding it difficult to sustain their development assistance for obvious economic reasons. But I'm very happy that Canada, together with a number of European countries and the US, is maintaining not only a very enlightened development policy, but also a good spend. So whilst I would accept that the country, that there are countries that have the means to solve and that perhaps they're not giving as generously as they might, let us not in any way belittle what is being done at the moment and the fact that we've got a really new focus on long-term structural causes of hunger that we haven't seen for some decades. So I'm probably more optimistic than you are. But thank you for your point, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you. I realize that there would be many more questions to ask of Dr. Navarro, but he must catch a plane in less than an hour, I think. And so we must bring this to an end very promptly. I will ask Dr. Harriet Kuhnlein, who is Professor Emerita of Human Nutrition and the founding director of the Center for Indigenous Peoples, Nutrition and Environment, to come forward and thank our speaker on your collective behalf. Dr. Navarro, thank you very much for your generosity. Ladies and gentlemen, the meeting is adjourned. Thank you for your presence. Have a safe trip.